So good evening, I guess it is. This is State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. I want to direct the attention of members of the public to our committee website, where you'll find a number of pieces of information. You'll find our agenda and various things there. So please check that out. Ms. Chambers, if you can please take the roll for this meeting.
Representative Pinto, chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney. Excused. Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Representative Wozlowicz.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott. Representative Wolgamott. We do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Thank you, members. Representative Pryor, if you could move approval of the minutes from our March 18th meeting.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Committee members, any discussion to that motion, into those minutes, any additions or corrections? So hearing none, all in favor of approval of our minutes from March 18th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and our March 18th minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Pryor. So members, this is a really important hearing. We're gonna be talking quite a bit about the finances that our committee oversees and talking about a number of things relating to that. But first, we're gonna hear a bill that kind of reflects our position as a committee in the middle of a number of different important things relating to child development, care and learning. That's an important proposal from my chair, Richardson, that perhaps should have come to our committee. It ended up going directly to the Health Committee, which will be making the final decision. But it was important to me to have us just be able to hear about it. And I appreciate Chair Richardson being willing to make the time to have us do that. And so, Madam Chair, welcome to our committee. If you could please, I guess we'll have you describe your bill. If I can first have Representative Pryor move House File 1268. I'm sorry, I guess this is information only, isn't it? So we don't need to do that. So in fact, Representative Richardson, we're going straight to you. So if you can please describe your bill and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1268 is a bill that is designed to address the disparities that we continue to see in infant outcomes as it relates to infant mortality and morbidity. The bill would actually appropriate $260,000 in fiscal year 2022 and $260,000 in fiscal year 2023 to the African American Babies Coalition as a way to address those disparities. I'm sure that you have heard within this committee, as we have heard in many other committees, that Black infants are twice as likely as white infants to die before their first birthday. And those deep disparities are persistent, and it is definitely a high priority to ensure that we are able to support parents and to support community for healthier pregnancies and also healthier supports for postpartum as well. Today with me, I have Samira Bilal Roby with the African American Babies Coalition to speak more about the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Richardson. And so Ms. Bilal Roby, if you can please identify yourself for the record and please proceed with your testimony. Welcome. Oh, we just need to get you unmuted though. There we go.
So sorry.
No problem. We've all done it repeatedly, in fact. Please, yeah.
Okay. Good evening, Chair Pinto and other members of representatives. And thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Samira Bilal Roby. I'm the director of the Wilder African American Babies Coalition and Projects. and Program Manager for the Integrated Care High-Risk Pregnancy Initiative. I'm a grandmother of 19. Imagine the building of pathways of healthcare and community education by empowering teens and youth by focusing on the partnership between pregnant mothers and fathers, and by ensuring that as a system, we are well prepared to raise healthy babies in Minnesota. Our mission is to create this world of this funding, that this funding would help us solidify, expand, and reach more families to improve change. Our work relies on design training with evidence-based messages. We cover a spectrum of topics, including prenatal care, birthing and delivery, postpartum, pediatric and parenting education, mental health awareness, engaged in inviting healthcare sites with appropriate caregiving approaches. Our action intent is increasing family resiliency, father inclusiveness from the beginning of conception without assumptions of capacity, and building a responsible Minnesota healthcare workforce. The key for us is changing behaviors built on increased knowledge, much of which we offer through courses with low barrier access to community. Again, this funding would help us bring these resources to even more Minnesotans. We are dismayed by the high rates of maternal and infant mortality in Minnesota, especially for Black and Indigenous mothers. Share concerned about these issues has brought us into work with companies like YouCare and other groups like the March of Dimes. The AABC and Projects is committed to doing everything we can to ensure that whole families, babies, and parents are set up with the tools they need to succeed. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. More specific examples of our work is community allies who actively take part in helping the mothers and fathers direct their destiny, understanding their power is within themselves for answers and energy, and making sure from a human stance, they know their rights during pregnancies. Involve men as doulas and to support new fathers. Parenting for kindergarten readiness and success, focusing on ACEs and the social determinants of health. We convene Minnesota agencies, clinics, and hospitals, and bi-yearly spring and action luncheons, moving as joint units, creating plans of referrals and access to care. With the leadership of agencies such as YouCare, United Healthcare, March of Dimes, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and Health Partners, to name a few, we are constructing specific activities to engage the entire community. I'm so sorry, I have asthma also that I got from wearing the mask through COVID. And then lastly, we have designed knowledge-based learning of high school students, youth healthcare awareness cohorts on health disparities and ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, symptoms, and to address many social behaviors. This is a means of prevention and intervention, discharging the awareness and training certification project for job preparation when reaching their next milestone in life. We deploy community host trainers to go out in houses of worship, community centers, or family dinners to discuss family well-being. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony and also for your long time work in this area. I've had the chance to work with Ms. Bilal Roby through the prenatal, the three policy forums that we hold quarterly, and I'm just really so much appreciative of your work. Members, Chair Richardson, I think we'll move to questions unless you had anything that you wanted to add before we do that.
No, Mr. Chair, questions would be great.
Okay, yeah, questions or comments. Representative Pryor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad that we have the opportunity to hear the bill in this committee. And I was able to hear it in the Health Committee, but I appreciate the second opportunity to focus on it and think about this very, very specific but very great need. One thing that I'm wondering about, and if our testifier, Ms. Bilal Roby, could talk a little bit about what's happened in this last year. I was talking to nurse practitioners. They're talking about the drop-off in preventive care, the number of unplanned pregnancies, and, you know, what's in front of us now. So is there a sense of, you know, probably when this bill was originally thought of and conceived, things have changed so much since then, and are we going to be able to catch up with what, or is this, are we going to be able to meet the need that's out there right now that's ahead of us?
Ms. Bilal-Roby.
I'm sorry. Well, I think that that's the importance of us getting the funding to do this expansion work and to hit the ground hard and running pretty fast. We will have to catch up, but we already are in the community working. We have a lot of allies to help us get the job done. And you're right. We right now look at our work as a safety net to pick up those pieces.
Representative Pryor, follow up? Okay. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this forward. I guess my question is this enough? Are there other organizations besides the Wilder Foundation that might be able to carry out this mission? Are we thinking big enough, or should we make these grants competitive, or, you know, what more can we do, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for your question as well. I really see this work as part of a network of projects and programs that are going on. Ms. Bilal Roby talked about the iChirp program, which is also, I think, an important component of this as well. And it is taking the view of not only thinking about infant mortality and morbidity, but also looking at maternal mortality and morbidity as well. There are also other House files, House File 660, for example, the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, is another opportunity to really begin to think about ways that we can be addressing the disparities that we're seeing in terms of Black women being 3 to 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth, and also looking at the disparities as it relates to infants as well. So yes, there's definitely more that needs to be done. I think that these are sort of three pieces of the puzzle, but would agree that there definitely needs to be more investment within services to address these disparities. And I think it's also important to recognize when we're looking at the infant mortality rates, and we're also looking at the maternal mortality rates, 60% of those maternal mortalities are preventable. So there's definitely like work that we can be doing.
If I can just, Representative Juergens, I'll say, Representative Richardson, am I also thinking, would another bill in that list be the one that would extend MA coverage beyond, just because it's a real short period of time, versus extending to a full year after a childbirth, because we certainly want to make sure the mom continues to have coverage. Would that be another bill in that list that you cited?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Morrison's bill would be another piece of the puzzle in terms of that extension of medical assistance. And, you know, and I would also just say that in terms of the data that we have seen in terms of the states that have adopted paid family medical leave programs,
right,
they've actually seen a reduction in infant mortality. They've seen a reduction in preterm births, and they've also seen a reduction in low birth weight babies.
Thank you. And sorry, Representative Juergens, for jumping in on that one. Please,
no, that's fine. That kind of leads into my follow-up question, is how will the results of this program be measured? So 2 years from now or 4 years from now, can we look back and say, these are the measurable results and you know, to justify greater investment?
Representative Richardson, or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for the question as well. You know, with the iChirp work that I know that Ms. Bilal Roby is also closely connected with as well, there are ongoing reports to the legislature that are required as a part of that. You know, some of the other, I guess, pieces to this puzzle I know that there are also some bills that look specifically at substance use disorders and tracking the number of babies that are born toxin-free, and those are reports that come back to the legislature as well. And I would say with the depth of the knowledge and expertise that Ms. Bilal-Roby and her group brings, they are definitely driven by the data, and they are good at collecting data and outcomes as it relates to things. And so I don't want to speak for Ms. Bilal-Roby, but I know that the evaluation piece is something that Wilder is known for within the state of Minnesota. So happy to, you know, if there are potential no tweaks to language, happy to discuss those. But I mean, that's what Wilder does. They're key within the evaluation field, especially as it relates to infant mortality and morbidity and maternal mortality and morbidity as well.
Representative Juergens, would you like to direct the question to Ms. Bilal-Roby?
If she has something to offer, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and as we do that, I just want to say ICHRP, everybody, stands for Integrated Care and High-Risk Pregnancies. At least our high-risk pregnancy, ICHRP. So just Representative Richardson used that term. Just want to make sure we all knew what that meant. But Ms. Bilal-Roby, can you shed some light on Representative Juergens' question?
Certainly. We're way ahead of it. We have it built in already. We're working with Router Research to pull all the data to see the impact, see if we have any gaps. So it is and will be continue to be built in with this part of the funding.
While there is an unusual institution that it's both a social service agency providing services, but then it also has tremendous research and evaluation capabilities inside of it. I'm not sure, I'm familiar with it, Representative Juergens, but it really is, that's a major part of their work, which is really helpful. But Representative Juergens, follow up?
No follow up, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And then I just had one final thing myself, I don't see other hands, but and I wanna describe this carefully, and Representative Richardson, you can help me think this through, but my understanding is that these, the figures are really stark when it comes to maternal mortality and infant mortality. The numbers that you referenced, they're not necessarily as stark for new immigrants to the U.S. is my understanding, and it seems like one significant explanation for that is racism in society. Is that the people that it does? I mean, I think there's a lot. My understanding is there's a lot of evidence that it sort of, you know, essentially builds up inside of people and really has an impact on the mom then and on an expecting parent. Is there any light that you can shed on that, or any comment you want to make on that observation? If I may be getting that wrong, but that's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. And yes, there's a lot of research that has been done in terms of looking at both maternal and infant mortality and morbidity. And I think that what is oftentimes stark and shocking for individuals when they're looking at it from the maternal side of things, you can control for general health, overall well-being, nutrition. You can control for educational attainment, for income. You can control for access to insurance, and you can control for mental health status, substance use disorder status. At every level of demographic, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth and pregnancy. And when you're looking at a Black woman, for example, who has an advanced degree, her birth outcomes are worse than a white woman who didn't finish high school. And so I think it's really important that as we look at these issues, it's not something that we are able to educate our way out of. It's not something that we're able to buy our way out of or health access our way out of. And in fact, you know, the reason that these issues really came to light was because of instances like Serena Williams and Beyonce Knowles almost dying during pregnancy. And Serena Williams' story was one, I think, that hit a chord with a number of people, because her story is one that so many Black women have experienced. She was experiencing a medical emergency. She asked for help, and her cries for help were ignored. Luckily, because she was Serena Williams, after a number of times of asking for help and asking for a CT scan, they were able to discover that she had developed blood clots in her lungs, and they were able to treat her, and she ultimately survived. But it was a 6-week tragedy that she sort of experienced that could have been prevented. And so the sad reality is that there are so many people who don't have the notoriety of Serena Williams and who have ultimately died, including individuals like Shaija Washington, who begged for help, didn't receive it, and died shortly after posting on social media about the treatment that she was receiving. And so what we're tending to see is, with these deaths that are preventable, women are asking for help, and their voices are not being heard or equally valued from a provider perspective.
Thank you. And part of the reason that I bring that up is of course, it's important to shine a light in general on what you just said, but also just thinking about if we want to think about expanding this or what more we can do. There's some of the specific bills you mentioned, but also probably just being aware of those stark issues and steps to dismantle those racial injustices in society. That itself is work that's consistent with this, to my mind. Representative Richardson, I'm sure final words that you may have on your bill. I don't see any other questions or comments from members, so please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present, and thank you to Ms. Bilal Roby as well for testifying today and all the work that she does in the community to support the healthy development of babies.
Thank you so much for this great proposal. I'm really glad we got a chance to feature this in our committee, even in this way. So thank you so much. And Ms. Bilal Roby, thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you. So that was just an informational hearing. So no need for any particular action, but now we do have a bill in front of us. House File 2287, Representative Pryor, if you could move to bring that bill in front of the committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I believe we've got Representative Munson, the bill's author, with us. There he is. And welcome, Representative Munson. Really glad to have you with us. And so if you could please present your bill. I understand you've got at least one testifier here. And so we'll go from there. So please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2287 is an appropriation bill for a child care center in Lake Crystal. It's a bedroom community in rural Minnesota, just south of Mankato. And there was a study done about 5 years ago that shows that we have about 90 childcare slots that are needed. And so the Little Lakers Childcare Center was formed as a 501c3 to look at possible facilities to renovate, to build a childcare center. And I have with me testifiers, Susan Gengler and Dina Voigt, and I think also maybe Tom Farrell might be on to discuss their project and the needs of the community. So I'll turn it over to, I guess, whichever one of the testifiers wants to unmute themselves.
I think we had Susan Gengler sign up ahead of time. We can, we should be able to squeeze in Ms. Boyd, but so maybe we'll go with Ms. Gengler first, if that makes sense. So you can just unmute yourself, please, and please identify yourself for the record, and welcome. Please proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for allowing us to testify on behalf of Little Lakers. My name is Susan Gengler, and I serve on the board of directors for Little Lakers, and I'm also on our local EDA committee. As a former community ed director, I noticed how childcare affected the local economy. First of all, mostly with the little children, and how they needed quality care in order to be ready for kindergarten, which then helped them throughout their school years, and then also helped them through the workforce. I've also talked to different businesses within our community in regards to the childcare need, and we've had businesses tell us that it's really hard for them to recruit and retain good employees without childcare. So some businesses have offered positions to engineers, and after they've taken a look at the community and looked for childcare options, they've turned the position down because of lack of childcare in our community. And so we are trying to look at restoring one of an empty building, which our co-op left and went to Mankato. And so they have a nice building for us, and we're working with them on trying to get a childcare with 84 slots. so that we can try to provide that need. And from there, I'll let Dina Boyd talk.
Sure, we'll move to that. So Ms. Boyd, please identify yourself and proceed. There you go.
Sorry about that. Hi, I am Dina Voigt. I am also on the Lake Crystals board. I am the VP on the board, and basically Susan has touched on a lot of things. The shortage that Jeremy Munson mentioned was about 90 to 100 slots. We believe that is higher now, that seeing how it was 5 years ago that study was done. We are facing challenges that Crystal Valley took away some jobs from our area because they moved to the Mankato. And we also have, like Susan said, that 14,000 square foot building sitting empty and not really going to fill that easily in our small community. That's a large space. So with that childcare crisis, we think we can, one, address the shortage in that building, also utilizing and filling that building up again, as well as employing and bringing more people into our area for the 20 to 24 jobs that this daycare will provide. The bill really is to help us to secure additional funds. We are fundraising. We are getting sponsors for this program, but it is a large amount of money for such a small community to afford this type of a project. And Tom is going to actually talk about financials, the actual dollars.
We can do that. So Mr. Farrell, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Tom Farrell, superintendent of the Lake Crystal Walk Memorial School District, and also the treasurer for the Little Acres Child Care Center. I've worked with the First Children's Finance in regards to the financial forecast of this and the feasibility of it. And it is a big undertaking, as Dina has mentioned. However, we've got a very committed group of people and has been working very hard. We just need a little help in order to make this project work. Our forecasts are that we will be, in the first year, we will be running a deficit just simply because of the startup costs, the equipment costs, the cost of staffing, and then ramping up. So what we're asking for is some financial help here, a grant to assist us to get through that first year startup costs. We're projecting about $150,000 to $200,000 shortfall. I think by year two, we expect to be operating in the black with this program. So we really think this is important to provide for the community. We are all volunteers working hard to provide childcare for a rural community. The need is great. As they said, home daycares are becoming harder and harder to for people to step up and do those. The center really is a good asset because it also provides one of the missions of this program or goals of the program is to provide support for our home child cares through professional development and support along that way. And so we really feel this is an important part of the community and the economic development and a service for families and children.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And thanks to all three of you for your work in moving this forward. Let's see, we've got Representative Franson. We'll move to you as for the first question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And first off, I just have to say, I am so happy to see Representative Munson here advocating for some childcare finances. And it looks like a good bill, Mr. Chair, and just pleased to see that Representative Munson here is bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Franson, and I'm sure Representative Munson appreciates your endorsement and support. Good stuff. Representative Pryor, you are up next.
All right. Yes, well, good to have you in the committee. And especially to be talking about this issue, because well, we've been here all along, and we know that it's not just your community that has this need right now, but it's probably, you know, big and small. It's really hard to make childcare work, and there's a huge deficit across the state. Parents are paying more than they can afford. The people that are working there are getting just like, you know, some of the lowest wages that we have of any profession in the state. And yet, it just doesn't work. And that's kind of where we are right now and what we're realizing in Minnesota. So, you know, we're trying to support, you know, every community, because we know that it, like you've already said, it is essential to your workforce to have quality, reliable childcare for people to work. So I guess, you know, it's great to hear that you're working with First Children Finance, because, you know, even if you have the startup money, which I'm assuming this bill is geared towards, which is actually a facility, a one-time cost, but it's really hard to keep a center going because, you know, your margins are so slim. And we heard already testimony that we had a fantastic childcare center that was, you know, operating for decades in Hopkins, Minnesota, in my community, and they closed down this year. The COVID took them out. So I do want to understand this bill too, that's in front of us right now. That is it, you know, what would the money be going for? Because, you know, we know that this is a need all across the state, and we as this, you know, we're not, the committee probably will not be able to finance every childcare on an ongoing basis across the state. So when you're talking about operating costs, I know that that's where things get really, really tight. So can you kind of address how this bill works in terms of startup cost, one-time cost, facility cost versus, you know, how is it going to work as on an ongoing basis, what the model is?
And it looks very much like you're probably sending that to Mr. Farrell, I'm guessing, Representative Munson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor, yeah, I believe it's startup costs and not focused on operating costs. But Mr. Farrell, if you could answer.
Yeah, Mr. Farrell.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairman. And thanks for the question. Absolutely. It is a large undertaking. We are occupying a building that has been vacated to meet all of the requirements and code requirements for early childhood. As you know, there are many for the safety of children. We have our estimates for construction and remodeling. Things are really expensive today, more so than we anticipated. And so, but we have approve the bids and moving forward with those, and we are on the process of the remodeling and construction to make the facility child care ready. There's equipment purchases, absolutely, the one-time costs, things to get the building ready for meals, classrooms, playground equipment, all of these things that you know, we have in our budget, but we're just a little short on funds to cover all those costs. We will be okay on operational once we're up and running, we think. First Children has done a great job here giving us a forecast. So, I think we also know that right now we've got 50 kids on the wait list. They've been in a holding pattern here, waiting to get into the program, and we're just on the verge of opening midsummer, if we can get a little extra funding here to help us get started.
Representative Pryor, I'd like to move to Representative Juergens if I can, unless you had something real quick. Okay. So then Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, it was the questions and the comments from Representative Pryor that made me think of this. Those are some excellent points. And we know from being on this committee all year and just prior to the committee work, what an issue it is statewide to have good quality child care, and that perhaps this is an idea that should be taken statewide, and not so much from the ongoing expenses, but just to help from the startup perspective, just to help get a center in the small towns throughout Minnesota And it may be, you know, the size of this bill may be at a zero or even two zeros, and go statewide with it and really help with those startup costs for child care centers across the entire state.
Well, that's a really nice, Representative Juergens, that's actually a nice transition to a point that I was going to make. And I'd speak to him briefly with Representative Munson about this. But
we're in sync, Chair Pinto, you and I.
Yeah, we are locked in, my friend. Because the committee did, in fact, hear several proposals by from Representative Liz Olson that would establish a much broader, a larger pool of funds. Those proposals, I think, are in the Workforce and Business Development Committee. And so one thing, I guess, I'd encourage the testifiers, Representative Munson, to do, and I think that perhaps even that process will have started, is to see how whether there's a way in which there could be funding for this idea that would come out of that. I'll be honest, I was especially interested in hearing this proposal right now that we, the timing was such, I know we're past deadline, so we will need to lay this over. But I it seemed like it really does shed a light on one community's experience. It really is, in that way, Lake Crystal's not unique. As we've heard in our committee, there's a real struggle all around the state. And in many ways, the economics of this sector just don't work. Maybe you can make it work ongoing with operating funds, although I'll note that we hear from a lot of providers that when push comes to shove, it's very, very difficult. The numbers just don't add up. Just like if we expected K-12 education to be funded entirely through private dollars, no public dollars, it just wouldn't work. And that's what this is. It's both education and care. Committee members heard me say this many times, so I'll stop. But to Representative Juergens, I think that's a great point. I'll encourage Representative Munson and the testifiers to connect with that broader effort and really to be thinking of this as being part of an illustration of a bigger issue. Representative Munson, though, you're the bill's author. Give you the final word on it. And to Representative Munson.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing the bill. And thank you to my testifiers for zooming in. Like Representative Pinto said, the Chair Pinto, this is Lake Crystal is very unique, just like every other town of Minnesota. It has the same problem. So I think this is representative of a larger issue. And I would hope that, you know, businesses would come to the table as well, because I think a lot of the small town businesses have a deep interest in this and to try to, you know, support their local child care centers. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Munson. Yeah, and a reminder to everybody that, of course, they have a long-term interest as well, because this is really about education for the future workforce, too. So it's all connected. Thank you so much again to the testifiers. And with that, the chair lays over House File 2287. And thank you so much. And then we're now pivoting then. And again, this is kind of a nice connection. We just heard this concern from one particular community in Minnesota. We're now going to be hearing presentations from several of our administration partners regarding federal funds that are maybe available to help address some of this, and then supplemental budget update. I want to apologize to the folks we're about to hear from. The first two bills took a little bit longer than I expected, and I really appreciate your patience. I know this is an incredibly busy time. And so I think the first presenter might be Joan Brandt from Department of Health. I believe there's a presentation. Again, reminder to members of the public that slides and all are on our committee website. So Ms. Brandt, are you the first? Well, let's see. I guess we'll see who starts.
I'm here.
Can you hear me? We can hear you just fine. Yeah, if you can identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joan Brandt, and I'm the Division Director of Child and Family Health at MDH. Thank you for the opportunity to present briefly this evening. So the first, you can go to the next slide, Stephanie, please. Thank you. So we are aware that both WIC, Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Program, as well as the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, are both going to get additional funding through the American Rescue Plan of 2021. We await hearing the specific amounts from our funders, from the feds. We have yet to hear specifics other than we know that we will be getting some funding. So that's about all I can give you this evening to that.
Thank you, Ms. Brandt. Actually, no, I may have, and members, I'll ask members of the committee, and if our testifiers are okay with this, then we'll ask some clarifying questions as we go along. I know that you may not know the exact amount. Do you have a sense? Can you just give us a sense for the MCFI funding as to any sort of restrictions that you may be aware of how it will end up being used? And I'll remind members of the committee that we do not oversee the account in terms of, on the budget side, but we do oversee the policy. And so I would love to get any input you have on that, Ms. Brandt.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I'm going to ask Dawn Reckinger. She talked to the project officer this morning and may have more specific information about if there are any criteria related to the funding. Dawn, are you on?
Ms. Reckinger?
Yes.
Do we have
yes,
you?
I am.
Yeah. Yeah. Please identify yourself and then you can help answer my question.
Sure. So my name is Dawn Reckinger, and I'm the manager of family home visiting at the Minnesota Department of Health. I did speak to our project officer for HRSA this morning about McVie. I said, I bet you don't know, but I'm going to be asked. And she said, we probably will get information in about 3 to 4 weeks, that it will be a very fast rollout. I asked about guidelines or anything they would know about. For those of you who may be familiar with McVie, we're required as a state to do a McVie needs assessment and to rank is maybe the wrong word, but to basically identify high-risk counties, high-risk areas of the state compared to state averages. And those are the regions of the state that are supposed to get priority funding for McVie. So I asked her specifically if this new money would be limited to those, to either current McVie grantees or anyone who is above the state average. And she really didn't know. She said certainly the money would be eligible for current McVie grantees, but whether we could use it for the rest of the state, she didn't know those guidelines. What we do know of what it can be used for is to support virtual home visits. I pushed on that a little bit and I said, so we're already helping our home visitors, you know, get technology and Zoom licenses and headsets and stuff like that. And we've done a little bit to help our moms that are receiving the services. But I said, does this mean we can buy iPads and we can pay for the phone bills or unlimited minutes so moms can participate in a home visit virtually? She said she didn't know, but that would be a question she'd bring back. We also know that the like one line bullet we see is that it could go for emergency food, diapers, other supplies like that. Again, I asked if that could be given to the whole state or is it limited. I gave her a specific example of a county where they have 10 of their 25 home visitors are paid on McVie, the other 15 are not. Obviously, we don't want to have and have not in the state. She didn't know. Some of you may have seen right now, McVie as a main program receives $400 million, just every year, $400 million. And Minnesota receives about 2.25% of that, which is around $9 million. If we assume that that same percentage would get used, then we might receive around $3 million or so. Complete guess on our part. That's about all I know.
And I see on the slide that it does need to be for evidence-based home visiting programs. Our committee had heard a proposal earlier to expand to evidence-informed and promising practices, but this does need to be evidence-based, that funding?
So McVie has two criteria. 75% of the funds must go to evidence-based programs. A state can use up to 25% for what is a promising practice and has to have a very thorough evaluation of that in place. I would imagine that might still apply. Again, we haven't received the guidelines, but I can say an evidence-informed program or a theory-driven program, I think would be highly unlikely that they would approve that.
Okay, that's helpful. And I'm just seeing if members have other questions, and I'll apologize in advance that I'm probably gonna have a bunch of questions. And members, I'll just emphasize that, you know, we've reached the point where we're gonna be making some pretty significant decisions in the next few business days as a committee, the next couple of weeks. And so part of the reason we're really needing to dive into this. Okay, I think that I'm sufficient with the MDH presentation. Pardon me, I don't see any other questions, so we can move on. And thank you so much, Ms. Brandt and Ms. Reckinger. We'll see who's up next. Maybe Ms. Burnham, I guess.
Yes. Good evening, Representative Peter Pinto and committee members. I am MDE is up next. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner of the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Department of Education, and With me tonight also is our Chief Financial Officer, Denise Anderson, and we are going to give you a brief overview of our federal funds. Next slide, please. So the federal funding has come in three phases of federal allocations, equaling up to just over $2.6 billion for education. The first round of funds was under the CARES Act, and the second round of funds, which came in December 2020, is the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. And then most recently was the American Rescue Plan. Next slide, please.
Actually, hold on. Before you move, could you go back to that prior slide? The lines, the row says K-12. Does that money, I guess I had thought that there was funding that is below kindergarten that's available for early learning, but perhaps that's wrong. Could you clarify that, or somebody could?
Chair Pinto, that's we have worked today in clarifying that. So if a public school offers a pre-K program, then that pre-K program will qualify for being eligible for these funds.
Okay, so it's the reference to K-12 is the reference to a school district that offers K-12 schooling,
right.
I gather.
In these future slides, we will be able to provide additional information about funds that will go beyond just those pre-K programs.
Okay, good. Thanks for the clarification. Yeah, please continue.
So round one of the CARES Act, could you go up back one slide? Okay. The round one priority was divided into the GEAR bucket and the ESSER bucket. The GEAR bucket being the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund, and the ESSER bucket being the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Fund. And for that ESSER money, 90% of that funds is formula based and goes to school programs. And the state receives 9.5% to be used in state directed grants to districts. And in the GEARS side of that bucket, the GEARS was dedicated really specifically to address the extreme technology and broadband needs that were realized in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, and to offer some summer school programming. And we offered a program that was a grant program for 0-8 wraparound services. These grants were for wraparound early care and education services for the birth through age 8 grade band, directed toward our historically underserved populations impacted by COVID. Half of these grants went out as competitive grants for educational entities in the metro area. The other half was distributed evenly to the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundations in outstate Minnesota to support the local programming in those areas. Roughly as of to date, we have spent about 23% of those funds, those grantees have. And I think an important note is that these funds are available through September of 2022. The ESSER funds were allowed to be used in a fairly broad manner. The early childhood specific uses that were encouraged to support, again, technology and staffing. Again, and these funds are available through September of 2022. Next slide, please.
Actually, Ms. Burnham, just a question on the last slide. So these allocations, these funds have essentially been pretty well allocated at this point, though, correct? This is sort of retrospective as opposed to prospective.
Correct. The CARES Act money has been allocated. These two
okay.
money have been distributed to schools and programs.
Okay, thank you.
Now, as the CARES Act also included funding specifically for Head Start and Early Head Start, and those federal Head Start funds are a direct appropriation from federal to local programs. So the federal funds were made available through the Office of Head Start for one-time supplemental funding. And the grantees can use these funds to operate supplemental summer programs and or repurpose funds for other one-time COVID-related activities. And so just over $10 million was awarded to the 45 Head Start entities across the state.
And Ms. Burnham, this funding does not pass through the state's hands at all. It goes straight from the federal government to these grantees. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chair Pinto. Okay.
Thank you.
Next slide. So the second bucket of money, which we call round two, is the Corona Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. And it too had a second round of the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund, as well as a second round of the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund. We just received LAC approval for this set of funds on Monday. And you can see that again, 90% of the ESSER funds will go to districts. Gear two bucket of money, just over $40 million will go to the non-publics. And other items in this area include $1 million to support the service cooperatives for staffing and subgrants for summer programming. Expand in-person summer programming at $57.5 million for increased staffing, transportation, enrichment, and PPE. And the early childhood focus in this second round of money is going to support the school-age care and youth programming. Just under $6.5 million is going to go to the school-age care and for staffing and administration. This money will go out in grants similar to how DHS ran their school age care grant programs. And we are estimating that approximately 3,500 children can be served through these programs. And it'll be likely based on the months of June, July, and August. So it's very much a summer related program. In addition,
please finish with this slide and then I'll have a couple of questions.
Okay. In addition, thank you, Representative. In addition, another 6.73 will go toward reducing the early learning scholarship wait list to the extent possible. And we anticipate that serving approximately 900 children. And then to round this appropriation out, $3 million will provide access to increased before and after summer school wraparound services and will be ran similar to the grant program that was discussed in the previous slide for the 0-8 wraparound services. And these funds are available until the end of September of 2023.
Time for the questions, Ms. Burnham, on this slide? Okay. So one question is the early learning scholarships, the title of that bubble is school age care and youth programming, maybe the youth part covered, but I'm just wondering, the early learning scholarships, I assume, are not for school age children. Those are for younger, but just wanted to clarify that. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, Chair Pinto, I need to confirm that. I believe it is for all ages in the early learning scholarship
program. So simply money off the wait list. And so it's going to be, again, prioritizing the 3 and 4 year olds, but then also the 0-2 year olds and the higher priority groups. Is that your understanding, Ms. Burnham, or do we have anybody who can help with that or could follow up later?
I believe that's correct, Chair, but we will confirm that and get back to you.
That'd be great. Another clarifying question, but a reminder to members, certainly feel free to raise hands and I'll be happy to call for your own questions. Then the wraparound services, just wondering what proportion of those either in that, I suppose it'd be in this $3 million or in the original CARES money went to public schools versus not versus others, or to you know, childcare providers, private providers, or sort of how can we think about how those different what the allocation's been with those wraparound services?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto. That's a really good question, and I am happy to get. We do track that to see where those grant programs went. I do believe the majority went to nonprofit programs and communities, but I will get that data over to you tomorrow.
That's great. Yeah, if we could just get a breakdown on that. That would be great, and does not need to be tomorrow, but you know, the next while would be the next week or so if you can. I know there's so much going on. And then the same question as the prior slide about the CARES Act. This at this point really is retrospective. I mean, these decisions have been made. It sounds like a lot of the funding has not necessarily been distributed yet, but at this point, kind of this particular cake is pretty well baked in that way that these decisions have been made, and this is how the money will be flowing out. Is that correct?
Representative Pinto, that is correct. We, in as mentioned earlier, and if I'm incorrect, Denise can jump in and correct me, but we just received LIC approval. So we are in the throes of getting plans in place to get this money out the door.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you. I think that's all I have. Again, members, I'm just looking to see if there's any hands raised, but there are not. And so please, Ms. Bruno, continue.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Next slide. And then our third round and third bucket of money is under the American Rescue Plan. And the feds really provided a much deeper level of guidance around this bucket of money and their intent on where it should go. So Minnesota will receive $1.32 billion in ESSER funds. And like the other two buckets, 90% of that will go out in formula-based to school districts. 5% must be used for interventions for learning loss, 1% for summer enrichment programs, and another 1% for comprehensive after-school programs, and 2.5% for other state activities, which is more of a flexible use, as well as 0.5% for grant administration. They also allocated a large sum of money for special education, and Part B and Part C are called out in this allocation to receive some funding in Minnesota, as are Library Services and Technology Act grants. And Head Start will receive an additional $11.755 million.
So a question on this slide. The Head Start line, I gather, is different than the Head Start slide before. This is the Head Start funding under the American Rescue Plan. The prior ones Head Start funding previously. I can see you nodding. So you're understanding that, right?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. And does it work the same way as the prior slide? I assume that money has gone straight from the federal government directly to those Head Start grantees and bypasses the state altogether?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And then otherwise... just trying to see if I have other questions on this. Certainly members, I can see Representative Pryor has a question, so we'll call on her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably should know this, but Head Start, is it that just Head Start, or is that also early Head Start?
Ms. Burnham.
Representative Pryor, thank you for that question. I believe it's Head Start and early Head Start, as it was in the previous slide.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then Representative Bolden. Had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was the exact same question as Rep. Pryor.
There we go. Great minds thinking alike. Good. And again, I'm just seeing if I've got anything wondering about. I guess we presumably, as with all the other American Rescue Plan funding, we're going to get a better sense as to the details in the coming weeks, I gather. And my apologies, by the way, your assistant commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Burnham, so please. But can you just give us a sense, do we have a sense of the timing for when we're going to get some more details about kind of exactly how this funding can be spent?
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I'm maybe going to see if Denise Anderson has a better idea around the timeline for that. I'm afraid I don't have that information tonight.
Okay. Ms. Anderson, can you shed any light on this?
Thank you, Chair Pinto. For the record, my name is Denise Anderson, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Education. So this bill was just signed into law March 11th. And so our first priority is to make sure that we get LAC approval, the state approval to spend the funds. So we have submitted that request and that's in the works. We are anticipating we'll get a response by like April 9th, I think is when we need to know that. So that's the first step. And then after that, we're still working with stakeholders and community members and listening to the needs in the area, in the field, to determine what the priorities for these funding should be. But you can see from this slide that there are some more significant restrictions than we had in the earlier funding sources. So mid-April, we'll have more information.
Okay, and more information from the, right, yeah, more of a sense. And I understand the federal government wasn't, when they put this together, was not necessarily keeping in mind our state budget constraints and timing. So we're kind of all scrambling and figuring things out. Good, well, thank you. That's really helpful. Not seeing other hands raised about this. So we'll move to your next slide if we can, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Just one more slide and just really to highlight again what we are hearing from the Education Department side of things around early learning. So the ongoing COVID mitigation around the need for the continued supply chain for cleaning and PPE, transportation issues, technology needs, equipment and connectivity. Facilities, remodeling existing space, creating new space, including outdoor spaces, the licensing process, workforce needs, you know, is across the board, early childhood through high school, looking at enrollment loss and ability to hold fees steady for family, and again, really looking at culturally appropriate meals for distance learning families. So those are just a few of the areas we are consistently hearing about ongoing needs and desires of communities.
And kind of identifying a list there. That's helpful. I see the next slide is your final slide. I actually did have a question going back one slide. My apologies. I got a little bit, my eyes got fooled by the phrase flexible use on that 2.5% because it made me kind of miss the second bullet, the 90% allocation of $1.2 billion. I know there's the restriction of 20% has to be used for learning loss. What sort of restrictions are there on the remainder of that $1.2 billion?
Again, I'm going to ask Denise Anderson maybe to come in and address that.
Ms. Anderson?
Chair Pinto and members, the federal law actually has a broad list of allowable uses. So, you know, PPE, cleaning, teachers, transportation, there's some facilities in there. So it's pretty broad, that category.
And there needs to be some sort of a COVID related connection, I would bet, but perhaps not.
No, exactly. All of the funds, that's the overarching, has to have some type of a tie to COVID response.
And which I'll note has pretty much impacted everything that we're doing in our society and state at this point, but that's helpful. But so it sounds like, but other than that, it sounds like that $1.2 billion, it's pretty flexible in terms of the federal restrictions is what I'm gathering from what you're saying.
Other than the $1.2 billion, yeah. Well, the $1.2 billion, the 90% that are allocated to the schools, is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, my apologies. That's what I was asking about, was the restrictions on the $1.2 billion. So perhaps, yeah, I may have misunderstood you. So yeah, what are the restrictions on that $1.2
billion? So 20% of that has to be spent to address learning loss. And then after that, it's the same answer. They have much flexibility. And that's actually allocated to the schools based on like the title formula.
Okay, I think I missed a really important point there, that it's money that goes directly to the districts then that they're then figuring out what to do with it with those restrictions that you've referenced. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, yeah, my apologies.
90% does, yes.
Okay, good. I hope members don't mind that I'm kind of asking these questions in this way, but I'm finding it helpful. So I'm going to continue running with it. Hopefully you are too. Good. So then that's helpful. Commissioner Burnham, I think that you were, seemed like you were done. Was there anything more you had in terms of your presentation?
I am good to be done, Representative.
And let me just see then, just making sure, any questions from members, not seeing any hands. Thank you so much to you and to Ms. Anderson for all of your work, and especially in being here with us on this Wednesday evening. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And then, yeah, I'm ready then to move to this is Commissioner Bailey. And so glad to have you back with the committee. Please confirm your identity and then proceed.
Good evening, members. Chair Pinto, I'm Lisa Bailey. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. And child care services, which is within Children and Family Services, includes Child Development Services and the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP. Thank you for the opportunity this evening to discuss the latest federal stimulus package. The American Rescue Plan was signed by President Biden on March 11, 2021. The act appropriates $39 billion for child care relief. Minnesota will receive a total of $537.2 million through the Child Care Development Block Grant, or CCDBG. CCDBG is also referred to as the Child Care Development Fund, or CCDF, which is the term that I'll use today. So I'm sorry if that's confusing. Next slide, please. The American Rescue Plan provides new and increased funding through the following three different CCDF fund types. The first one is that Mandatory Child Care Development Fund, and that's $9.2 million over the coming 2 years. This is an overall increase in our already existing CCDF funds. It modifies the state match requirements for fiscal year 2021 and 2022 for funds appropriated by ARP, or the American Rescue Plan. The Federal Office of Child Care is providing further guidance about this increase, about whether or not it's one time or temporary. All allowable uses under the CCDF apply to this increased funding. The second bucket is the CCDF Discretionary Supplemental Fund. This is $203 million. Allowable uses for this bucket of funding are broad and include all uses allowed under the existing Child Care Development Fund. These funds may also be used to provide child care assistance to employees working in healthcare, sanitation, emergency responders, and any other employment deemed essential without regard to income eligibility requirements that are specified usually by the CCDF. Language on the eligible use, as I said, is very broad and has more flexibility than previous stimulus funding. Some of the eligible uses include non-COVID-19 related expenses. Our previous federal stimulus funds were required to be tied to COVID-19 relief. That is not a requirement in the ARP. It also allows subsidies for essential workers, as I said, regardless of income, and direct services for families, such as services paid by the Child Care Assistance Program, and quality dollars that in Minnesota have previously been directed more towards provider and family supports by grants and contracted services. And then finally, the largest bucket is the third one is the Child Care Stabilization Grant, $325 million. These funds are to be used to provide stabilization grants to child care providers. Any eligible child care provider can apply for that grant. Eligible providers will include all licensed and regulated providers who are open or closed for COVID-19 related reasons. Grant amounts must be based on the provider's stated current operating expenses, including costs associated with providing care or preparing to provide care. And applications will be processed on a rolling, or must be processed on a rolling basis. The American Rescue Plan outlines several allowable uses of those stabilization grants, and those include staff compensation, benefits, premium pay, staff training, rent, mortgage payments, utilities, facility costs, PPE, cleaning supplies, mental health supports. We must offer some relief to family tuition and fees to the extent possible. And they can be used to reimburse providers for funds spent to respond to COVID-19 prior to the passage of the ARP. Goods, and as well as goods or services needed to remain open or to reopen. So it's fairly broad, those uses. Next slide, please. There are several deadlines that we'd like to bring to your attention that are included for these funds under the ARP. For the mandatory child care development funds, those must be obligated by September 30th of the following year. This deadline is the same as our previous TCDF mandatory funds. The supplemental discretionary child care funds, ARP gives states and territories an additional year to spend those funds. These funds must be obligated, therefore, by September 30th, 2023, and liquidated by September 30th, 2024. That's 1 year longer than we had with the previous federal funds that have been allocated. And finally, for the Child Care Stabilization Grant funding, these funds must be obligated by September 30th, 2022, and liquidated by September 30th, 2022.
Assistant Commissioner, I saw that your final slide is about the CRRSA, so the prior funding. And I wonder if it makes sense for us to maybe ask some questions regarding the American Rescue Plan funds first and then get to that, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Because this it seems like they're sort of separate things. I know I have a bunch of questions. I don't know if other members will as well. One thing is if you can, maybe just back one slide, if I can. The child care stabilization grants, I may have just lost, if you all can, will be able to hear me okay. Let's see here. The child care stabilization grants, can you just talk about how they might be able to be, talk again about how they might be able to be used? They have got to be through an application process to child care providers. Is that correct? That's the money has to go directly to providers. It couldn't go, through subsidies for families necessarily. It has to be grants. Can you just talk a little more about the stabilization grants and what the federal rules are on those?
That's correct, Chair Pinto. Thank you for that question. Those funds are to go to the providers themselves, and my understanding is that will be a fairly similar process to what was done with the previous rounds of funding. I think we're looking into exactly how that's all going to go out, but the grant amounts, like I said, must be based on the provider's current operating expenses, and the ARP actually outlines the uses of those grants.
So I was not aware of that point about the grant amounts needing to be based on operating expenses. If you could provide that information to us to where that's coming from, that'd be really helpful to understand that.
Mr. Chair, I'm certain we can certainly come and get more information for you on that. My understanding is so that the grant amounts, and this is a change that must be based on the provider's stated current operating expenses, including costs associated with providing care or preparing to provide care. And then, as I said before, that the applications must be processed on a rolling basis.
That would be, that would be very, very helpful if we could get that. And that might be, if it's possible to get that in the next day or two. I don't know if that is possible, but would be very helpful. The information that you read. Yeah,
we can certainly get you what we have. I think we're all also just looking into this ourselves and trying to figure out the details. So we'll be able to do that.
Understood. Yeah, it's similar, and I know it's the same as when we were talking with MDE. That sort of there'll be a lot that will become clearer. But as we're just trying to make decisions, even in the coming days and weeks, that'll be very, very helpful. Let me think. I thought that I had a couple of other questions, but I'm struggling to remember what they are right now. I'm not seeing other hands, and so perhaps, unless it comes to me or anybody has anything, maybe we should go to your final slide in the meantime and at least get that cleared out. So my apologies, yeah, about that.
Great. To close out, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to provide a brief update on the use of the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriation, which was passed in late December 2020. Through this federal appropriation, DHS is issuing $135 million to support child care providers and families they service through five different efforts. First, to infuse $35 million into the basic sliding fee program over calendar years 21, 22, and 23 to increase the number of children served off agency waiting lists. Next, to set aside funding for family support initiatives over the course of the next 6 to 12 months to target support to emerging needs. Third is continuing the COVID-19 Public Health Support Funds program with $87 million for January through May of 2021. Next is providing funding to support childcare programs to build sustainability, reopen or start up through consultation, business supports, grants, and loans. And finally, providing funding to continue efforts to provide support to the family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. And those that we had previously discussed those, but we just wanted to give you that update. That's where we are right now.
Yeah, thank you. I'd say whatever additional detail you have regarding these would be really helpful. I know I can think of one question that springs to mind, which I'll ask right now. Anything that is maybe available. My question had to do with the waiting list, the first line there. Can you give a sense as to the impact of that? Kind of the phrase on there is to address waiting lists. Do we have a sense as to sort of where waiting lists will be following this infusion of funds in each of these years?
Mr. Chair, it's a great question. I don't have a response for you right now. I think we're really literally at the point of trying to get these funds out the door. And so I don't think we have an estimate of that at this point, but we're certainly willing to come back and discuss it.
If you could, that would be really helpful. And again, as we're making some decisions soon, any detail you can provide shortly would be real helpful. So yeah, whatever you're able to get to us on that would be much appreciated.
Happy to do that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I guess also I'm especially interested. You may be aware, Assistant Commissioner, we heard a proposal from Representative Howard to expand support for family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. And I guess that one jumps out at me as being one that I'm especially interested in more details on. Well, this is probably true on all five of these lines. So whatever you're able to provide would be great. So thank you so much. And I'm again looking to see if there are member questions. Please feel free to raise hands. Representative Pryor, you've got one. We'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just kind of to try to understand this at a higher level, it seems like the federal money and the different legislative acts that we're recipients of, it seems like they're set up differently of what is available, choices that we can make or can't make. So even this, the new money that's coming from the American Rescue Act, can that be used for the basic sliding fee?
Or Commissioner Bailey? Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That was it.
Okay, sorry, I jumped in too quickly. Commissioner Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, I don't have a good answer for that at this point. I think that's something we're looking into. I'm going to see if I have anyone. I don't think I have anyone here who can address that tonight. Although I'm learning that it is possible that we would be able to use those funds for the basic sliding fee. So I can confirm that. And actually I'm hearing now that it can be. Again, as I said, we're looking at this every day, getting new information about literally trying to understand exactly what these things can be used for. But it looks like it can be used for the basic sliding.
Representative Pryor, follow up? Doesn't seem like it. Okay. I can't quite see it.
Interesting. There's a lot of money in it, just figuring out where the, but and a lot of ongoing need, but still only one-time limited funding. So I guess that's the difficult balance to make.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll ask a couple of other things, see if members have other questions, but Mr. Bailey, so back to the stable, I guess maybe if we can go back one slide, why don't we do that first? Thank you. Just wondering about the timeline for some of these things. I guess I'm especially interested in the child care development funding. I guess I'd thought, so just want to confirm that the funds have got to be spent by September 2024. Even if they do get obligated by a later date, is that, I don't know if you just want to make sure that I'm clear on those, on these dates. Is there anything that pushes them off in any other direction, or are they, I'm pretty firm no matter what else happens with the funds?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand the question. If you could just clarify.
Well, so my sense was that it was possible that because some of the funds would not be received until next year, that in fact some of these deadlines would be pushed off by a year because of the timing when they're received. You know, funds received now have to be liquidated by September 2024. Funds received next year would have to be liquidated by potentially by September 2025. I had the sense that that might be true. Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information, and I don't know that we know that yet, but we can certainly look to get that to you as soon as possible.
That would be great. Thank you. Yeah. I don't know if it would be under a federal or under our state law, but yeah, if you can look into that, that would be great. Thank you. And then a question going back one more slide. And again, members, please feel free to raise hands. And so the stabilization grants, another question about this, do they have to be universal or could they potentially, as in past rounds, or could they potentially be targeted in some way?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand universal, what you mean by that?
So like the current grants, where they simply go out based on the applications regarding simply provider operating costs in that way, as opposed to, for example, being targeted to populations, let's say, that are lower income or targeted in some other way.
Oh, I see.
Like providers serving such populations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's something we're looking into now, and looking into whether or not there are we have the ability to set those kinds of parameters, or if they need to be universal. So we don't have that information at this point.
Okay, that's helpful. Good. I really appreciate you going through and kind of being in the weeds with us on this. Thank you so much, as we're making a lot of decisions, or will be soon. Members, I am not seeing hands raised from any of you, which is just fine. And so Commissioner, I think that then kind of gives us what we need, I guess. We've kind of made a number of requests for follow-up. And so if you can get that to us as you can, I know this is such a busy time. And thank you so much to you and your whole team for your work. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think we're good on that. I'm not sure. I think maybe some of the same folks are going to be coming back up and hearing about our supplemental. Hearing about our supplemental administration supplemental budget proposals. And so I guess we will move to that at this point then. And I think there's just a few clarifications or a few changes there. So Ms. Brand, I think that you are up again, being the first person.
I believe I am, Chair Pinto.
Okay.
So Chair Pinto, committee members, moving on to the governor's supplemental budget, Representative Richardson and Ms. Bilal Roby this evening's presentation really provided great background for our specific asks related to reinstating the fetal infant mortality review. We are asking for $622,000 in this biennium coming up.
If I can pause you just a second, I think that there is a presentation that reflects this. I could be wrong. Perhaps you were waiting to bring it up. I'm not sure, but just wanted to make sure in case there was.
Yeah, I think, Stephanie, do you have the PowerPoint again? Oh.
Is it? Sorry.
Thank you.
There we go.
There. Thank you. So as you can see, we are asking for $622,000 for the biennium in order for us to reinstate the fetal infant mortality review. And I a few weeks ago, Karen Fogg presented on exactly what that entails. We also are looking to add morbidity to the maternal and mortality review at this point, to the tune of $396,000 in the biennium. And then when we were asked to take some budget reductions, we looked at where we would have the least amount of impact on service delivery. And thus we recommended right-sizing the Nurse Family Partnership Home Visiting Grant, the one-time only reduction based on underspending of funding. So about $400,000 each year. In addition, we are suggesting right-sizing the fetal alcohol syndrome grants, again, just a one-time reduction to the Proof Alliance organization who provides those services. Again, this is based on underspending during the fiscal year. So,
Ms. Brandt, can you remind me, please, the home visiting grants, that the reduction, is that something that was a change between the original proposal and the supplemental proposal? Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. This is in the original proposal, it was an ongoing reduction. It has changed to just a one-time reduction now.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. So it's actually less of a reduction than it,
correct.
Than it was.
Yep.
All right, thank you. And I should have, and members, I should have noted, members of the public as well, at the very start of this, that these changes are reflected in an attachment on the website that's marked HF2230A2. It's an A2 language in the amendment. So in terms of the actual bill language in the administration, this is getting a little bit confusing because of just where we're at in the schedule here. We had heard HF2230, which contains the administration's proposals previously. We're now hearing that language, or having it presented to us. And so just want to make sure, members, that that's where the actual language is. So thank you. Let's just see if we have any questions for Ms. Brandt at all. Recognizing that these accounts are in fact in the health area, and so it's good to be aware of them, but they will not be in our committee's jurisdiction in the end. So I don't see any questions. So Ms. Brandt, thank you so much
for
the presentations. Yeah, and for all of your work, for your really important work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and I think perhaps, I don't know if it's System Commissioner Bailey. Yes, you are back up.
I'm back.
And you are back.
Thank you.
Welcome. Yeah, please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. And I don't have slides today. I just have two childcare related recommendations. First, the governor's revised budget includes a recommendation to limit retroactive payments for the child care assistance program. This proposal is a savings proposal, which decreases retroactive payments for eligible families from 6 months to 3 months, while preserving current retroactive eligibility policies for new applicants. This aligns with the intent of retroactive eligibility policies and promotes consistency and simplification, and it would save approximately $1.27 million in the 2022-23 biennium. We think this addresses program integrity concerns from county and tribal CCAP staff by limiting a problem that has allowed for childcare to be billed when it is questionable if services were provided. There's not a feasible way to verify that childcare was provided in the past. This bill limits that time frame to 3 months instead of 6 months. In addition to county and tribal CCAP staff, the department consulted with employment services staff and early childhood advocates to develop this proposal. The second proposal in the governor's revised budget includes a recommendation to refinance the peacetime emergency childcare grants to the Coronavirus Relief Fund. So this proposal moves $23.59 million from the CRF, the Coronavirus Relief Fund, in the federal fund of the state treasury to the general fund to retroactively pay for the peacetime emergency child care grants that were enacted last year in March. This proposal does not provide any additional grants or services. It's a technical change in the funding source for existing expenditures. By shifting these expenditures to federal sources, the state is able to reserve general fund resources for other purposes. There are no negative impacts to the peacetime emergency child care grants to the over 3,100 child care providers who received peacetime emergency grants as this program operating last April to June of 2020 has included. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for that. And members of staff corrected me that the A2 amendment reflects the DHS changes. It does not reflect the MDH changes, the health department changes, because again, those are not in our committee's jurisdiction. So we are in an odd spot here in the Early Childhood Committee, being between a lot of things, so having to kind of make our way. But it's important we do that. So Representative Pryor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Bailey, could you say again how much money that would be, retroactively shifting the funding source for those child care grants, the second point that you made?
Thank you.
Commissioner Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, that would be $23.59 million.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments from members? Not seeing any. And so I think we're good. Commissioner Bailey, thank you so much to you for working through all this with us. A number of things tonight, and apologies that things got a little bit later, and we really appreciate your work. Thank you so much. Members, we're going to have a couple minutes after Commissioner Bailey leaves that I just want to make sure to address a few things. But again, thank you to you and your team for your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, pleasure. So members, just a few comments to kind of lay out where we're going to be in the next couple of weeks. You are aware that the committee received a budget target yesterday. I'm proud to say that this is, I think, the first time that an early childhood committee or area has received a public budget target. It's a $50 million increase over the base. And we also know, as we've heard tonight, that there are federal funds that have a significant impact in our area. Again, it was important to me to hear the proposal from Representative Munson because in a way it illustrates what we've been hearing for the last few months, which is that there is a massive, massive need in this area. It really just reflects a deep under-resourcing, not just in money, but also in time and attention for so long in this area. We know that if we simply add up the early care and learning needs just of children at the lowest areas of poverty, below 185% of poverty, I want them to receive high quality early care and learning, which I know we all do. That is getting close to, especially if you include home visiting, $1 billion or more. So there's a massive need. And so what we're going to be doing as a committee is looking for every opportunity we can to make sure that we address that need in every way that we can. So the plan is that once we come back from break or as we are coming out of break, I expect that I'll be releasing a proposal for the committee's consideration. It'll use the House File 2230 as the vehicle, as the base that contains the administration's proposals. There will be a delete all amendment to that bill. Though I'm certain we'll be keeping portions of it, of course. There's a lot of good material from the administration. Then in the week of April 5th, we'll be walking through that bill, receiving public testimony on that bill, and then certainly entertaining any amendments that folks may have to that bill, with the plan being that we will vote it out that week of April 5th to the Ways and Means Committee. And then it's important for folks to understand that in that committee, I'll present the bill, but it will then be broken up into pieces to go with the Education Finance Bill from Chair Dabney's committee and with the Health and Human Services Bill that will be coming out of the committees chaired by Representative Liebling and Representative Schultz. And then that's how it'll be considered on the floor. And then the plan is to go to conference. I wanna make sure to lay this out for all of you, members of the public, to understand what the plan is. Are there questions from members regarding that process or anything else, how this is going? I will note that I've been in real good touch with Lead Franson. And we'll continue to do so. But certainly if members have questions at all, please feel free to ask either now or at another time. I am not seeing anything. I will encourage members and members of the public to certainly please be in contact with me as I'm putting together this proposal for your consideration as a committee. As you can see, the federal funds have play a really important role in our work, as does just about everything else that we're doing. So. I was stalling for time for a second to see if anybody wanted to raise their hands and ask a question, but I'm not seeing anything. Members, let's continue to be in touch. Again, members of the public, feel free to reach out to us as we're making these important decisions. We have a massive need to make sure that kids get off to a great start for the benefit of all of us, and we're just figuring out how we can best meet that within the structures that we're in. So we'll continue doing that. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great night. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.